Today, I want to talk about what has been the most profound change in America in my lifetime, the elimination of official racial discrimination. By this, I mean the hateful, legally sanctioned separation of white and black America, which has characterized too much of our nation for too much of our history. To do so, I will revisit one of the pivotal events in the civil rights struggle, the saga of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. In 1964, these courageous people fought to open up the political process in Mississippi to black citizens. In that broiling summer, they took their cause to the Democratic National Convention in Atlanta, where they forced the party to confront the ugly segregation in its midst. What happened there permanently and profoundly changed both the Democratic Party and America. Since I played an important part in that drama, that's what I'd like to talk about, what I did, what happened, and why I think it was important. 36 years ago, America was a far different country. It's almost impossible to explain to young people how pervasive discrimination was back then. In too much of the nation, jobs, housing, transportation, schools, even drinking fountains were segregated. And millions of blacks, particularly in the South, were denied the right to vote. The civil rights movement was born from these conditions. In Mississippi, where blacks lived in a police state, the struggle was especially painful. Young organizers like Bob Moses had tried since 1960 to register black voters in that state. But they made little headway, and the violence they endured went unnoticed by the rest of the country. By 1964, Moses and his colleagues were weary. They had been beaten and terrorized, and they desperately needed a new strategy. So they came up with a bold new project that they called Freedom Summer. They recruited an astonishing 1,000 volunteers from around the nation, mostly white college students from the North, to come to Mississippi to register black voters. They knew this was a desperate strategy, that these students would be exposed to danger just as they had been, but they believed this time their suffering would attract national attention to the terror undergirding Mississippi segregation. They also believed that the FBI, which had refused to become involved in these disputes, wasn't even in Mississippi at the time, would be forced to move into Mississippi if this time the victims were white. This desperate strategy quickly proved correct. In fact, on the very first day of Freedom Summer, three young organizers, Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, both white, and James Cheney, an African-American, disappeared. 6 weeks later, their bodies were found by the newly arrived FBI. Their murders and the beating and jailing of the volunteers caused a national uproar. As national attention turned to Mississippi, Moses and his colleagues worked with Joe Rao, a brilliant Washington attorney, on another project of the Freedom Summer, the formation of what they called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. They decided to challenge Mississippi's white-only regular delegation at the upcoming Democratic National Convention, demanding that they be seated instead. Other Democratic state delegations, including Minnesota, pledged their support. But the Freedom Party's strategy put them on a collision course with the white power structure of the South and with President Lyndon B. Johnson. It had been less than a year since Kennedy's assassination, and Johnson saw the convention as his chance to step out of Kennedy's shadow. He was afraid that seating the Freedom Democrats would incite a walkout of southern and border states and hand the election to Barry Goldwater. In 1964, I was 36 years old and a fairly new Attorney General of Minnesota. On August 20 of that summer, I flew to Atlantic City, having been appointed as a Minnesota member of the Credentials Committee, along with Jerry Joseph. While I knew about the Mississippi Challenge, I had never been to Mississippi and had no in-depth knowledge of the issues. But foremost on my mind was that Hubert Humphrey had a good chance of being nominated for vice president. And I wanted to help him, and I wanted to see Johnson and Humphrey win in November. The excitement that I and some of you in this room felt about helping Humphrey become vice president was central to everything I did at the convention. It wasn't until the Credentials Committee met on Saturday, August 22nd, that I began to understand how serious the Freedom Democrats' challenge was. In a powerful presentation, we heard Joe Rau and Aaron Henry, Reverend Ed King, Roy Wilkins, and Martin Luther King Jr. testify for the Freedom Democrats. But it was a sharecropper named Fannie Lou Hamer who transfixed the room and the nation as she told of being shot at, beaten, and arrested for urging her fellow citizens to vote. Let's take a look at Fannie Lou.
Mr. Chairman, and to the Credentials Committee, my name is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, and I live at 626 East Lafayette Street, Greenville, Mississippi, Sunflower County, the home of Senator James O. Eastland and Senator Spence. If the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook, because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America?
The power of the Freedom Democrats case completely changed the politics of the convention. Many of us had arrived in Atlantic City already persuaded that they had justice on their side. But whatever idea we had about solving the problem by simply pledging future reforms suddenly evaporated in the face of Fannie Lou Hamer's eloquence. On Monday morning, the 110 members of the Credentials Committee began discussing compromise proposals that had been floating around the convention. But there was absolutely no sign of consensus, and emotions were running high, to say the least. I suggested that we form a small subcommittee. The chairman, Governor Lawrence of Pennsylvania, agreed, made me chairman, and appointed two other northerners and two southerners, five-person committee. So there I was, a young politician, barely acquainted with Mississippi, untested in national politics, but now in charge of keeping the convention from blowing apart. So I convened our subcommittee, and off we went to our flea bag hotel to meet all night. We were under enormous pressure. Johnson, who was good at these things, had let Humphrey know that his chance at the vice presidency depended on his brokering an acceptable compromise. Johnson's staff, Humphrey's people, UAW President Reuther, Bayard Rustin, and others shuttled between meetings of the civil rights leaders, the Freedom Democrats, and other delegates, trying to find and sell a solution that would keep this issue from exploding on the convention floor. Under the rules, the Freedom Democrats needed only 11 votes in the Credentials Committee and the support of 8 states on the floor to bring this issue to the convention for a debate and a vote, where they might win. But Johnson was absolutely determined not to risk a floor vote and a walkout. I spent 3 days working with the subcommittee on the seating question. I favored a rule to bar segregated delegations at future conventions, because I thought this would force black and whites to work this out in their own states and lead to healthier state parties. The no segregation rule for future conventions was among four proposals that were being discussed. Johnson himself had okayed that proposal, and White House staff had discussed it with Rao. But that proposal didn't offer any seats to the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegates at this convention. The Freedom Democrats' strength, meanwhile, had been building throughout the summer, and with their powerful testimony, they had captured the momentum of the convention. The stakes had been raised. Now we knew that the issue of whether any of the Freedom Democrats would be seated as delegates would make or break the compromise. On Tuesday morning, 4 days after we heard Fannie Lou, I had breakfast with Humphrey, Reuther, Governor Lawrence, and Tom Finney, the staff director, who was close to the White House. We outlined the subcommittee's proposal as it stood at that point. It contained the elements the administration and others had already supported: non-discrimination rule for future conventions, creation of a commission to enforce the rule, a requirement that all delegates had to sign a loyalty oath, which we knew the Mississippi regulars wouldn't sign, and a plan to seat all the Freedom Democrats as honored guests, but not as delegates. Then we added a new recommendation to symbolize the party's commitment to integration and to affirm the justice of the Freedom Democrats' cause. We urged the convention to seat Aaron Henry and Ed King of the Freedom Party at one black and one white as delegate at large with full voting rights. Everyone at that breakfast agreed to the plan, and we knew we had to act that day. The convention had already gotten underway with the Mississippi seating issue still unresolved. Humphrey and Reuther spent the next hours trying to sell the proposal to convention leaders, including the Freedom Democrats. After breakfast, I reconvened my subcommittee and moved the adoption of the compromise. Through Tom Finney, the White House had communicated its support. After some final discussion, our subcommittee voted on the proposal, and it passed by 3-2, with the two Southerners voting no. The subcommittee had completed its job, and now I was under pressure to get our proposal adopted by the full committee at a meeting to be scheduled early that afternoon. As I headed to the full Credentials Committee meeting, I felt we'd come up with an honorable solution to a difficult problem, and at that time, at least, I hoped the Freedom Democrats could accept it. I bumped into Joe Rao, who was an old friend, on the way to the committee meeting. He had heard the details of our proposal from Walter Reuther, who had demanded that Rao support it. Rao told me that if I could give him a little time, he thought he might be able to persuade the Freedom Democrats to accept it. We were friends. I trusted him. I said I would try to help get him the time, and I did try to do so. But when the committee reconvened in closed session, I made my presentation. I acknowledged that our proposal didn't go as far as either side wanted, but I said it recognized the problem of discrimination in the party and put in place a plan of action to end it. I presented our proposal and made my arguments for adoption. Joe Rao then asked for a recess to allow him to discuss it with the Freedom Democrats. But at that point, Chairman Lawrence pushed for an immediate vote. The committee was demanding action, and I'm sure that the White House was behind that, because they were fearful that Rao would use this time to stir up further pressure. In any event, after 4 days, an impatient committee adopted our proposal on a voice vote. Rao later tried to get the signatures for minority report, but he couldn't get enough of them to qualify under the rules. I then walked straight from the committee room to the largest news conference I had ever seen in my life, where I announced the committee action. The timing of the committee vote, my announcement of it, have been sources of controversy ever since. Many of the Freedom Democrats learned about the committee vote from the television news while Humphrey and Reuther were still trying to persuade them to accept the compromise. When Bob Moses saw the announcement, he screamed, "You cheated," and stormed out of the meeting. He was convinced that the Freedom Democrats had been tricked. He thought they had been called to a meeting with Humphrey while the Credentials Committee was voting in order to stop them from rallying support for their position. To make matters worse, some of the news reports suggested that the Freedom Democrats supported the proposal. In fact, they hadn't yet decided what to do about it. I wish we had given Rao some time to caucus with the Freedom Democrats before we acted, but we didn't. I wasn't able to deliver on my promise to Joe. Certainly, the Freedom Democrats were entitled to a decent interval to consider our proposal. I am not proud of how this was handled, but I do believe the proposal itself was a good resolution of the issue. There was plenty of hardball politics going on behind the scenes. Johnson wanted this issue settled, and he leaned hard on the Freedom Democrats supporters to go along with him. There is no doubt that the White House pushed to get a fast committee vote once they knew that support for the minority report had vanished. But even without a trick meeting, and I don't think it was, the compromise would have passed. We had debated it for 4 days, and the compromise went further than most people, including Johnson, had expected. But as it turned out, both the Mississippi Regulars and the Freedom Democrats angrily rejected the compromise. All but 3 white delegates walked out. The 3 that stayed, incidentally, did so despite death threats from Mississippi. And the Freedom Democrats angrily rejected as well. They were particularly angry at being given only 2 at-large seats and having the delegates for those seats chosen for them. As Fannie Lou Hamer shouted, "We didn't come all this way for no 2 seats." Many of them spent the rest of the convention protesting, and some remain bitter to this day. I'd like to spend a few minutes on Lyndon Johnson, as this episode raises many questions about what kind of a president he was and where his sympathies were. Johnson was the first president I came to know quite well. He was a product of the old South, the Democratic South, and many of his oldest friends and allies were from the same tradition. Johnson played hard politics, and he could be a conniver, too. But there was another Lyndon Johnson, and that's the one I liked. He had grown up in poverty and had taught in a poor rural school. He sympathized with the plight of poor people and genuinely believed in civil rights. This fight over Mississippi put him in a big bind. One side said he was moving too fast on civil rights. The other side said he was moving too slowly. One side thought he was caving into the segregationists. The other thought he was giving the Democratic Party away to the upstarts in the civil rights movement. Thankfully, we now have some astonishing radio tapes which allow us to hear Johnson's private White House conversations. I can't believe that Lyndon knew this was ever going to happen, but it did. The tapes reveal that Johnson was frustrated by the Freedom Democrats and wanted to do whatever he could to stave off their challenge. But he was more disgusted with the white Southerners who wouldn't give him any help or running room on civil rights. When Georgia Governor Carl Sanders, who was considered a moderate in those days, called Johnson in the middle of the convention to complain about the 2 seats being given to the Freedom Democrats as being too many, Johnson finally blew up. Let's listen to him for a minute.
But what they ought to be now, honestly, between you and me, with their population 50%, they ought to be delegates in the Mississippi group.
Not unless they're Democrats, Mr. President.
They're Democrats, and by God, they tried to attend the convention, and pistols kept them out. These people went in and begged to go and participate in the convention. And they got half the population. And they won't let them. They lock them out.
John Richardson. They got half the population.
Well, some of them are registered. Well, that's enough to get two delegates on here. I mean, you recognize them. John Connally recognizes them. I think you've got a good, legitimate case to say that the state of Mississippi wouldn't let a Negro come into their damn convention, and therefore they violated the law and wouldn't let them vote, wouldn't let them register, intimidated them, and by God, they ought to be seated.
This was a different Johnson than was on the news those days. Here was the president making the Freedom Democrats argument for them. He was trying to convince an old Southern friend to concede a shred of decency, and he was disgusted that they wouldn't. What happened in Atlantic City changed everything. The Democrats finally abandoned the segregationist Old South. That's what I grew up with. When I first went to the Senate, I came back in the first day and I told Joan, I took French at McAllister, I should have taken Southern. Because almost every committee was chaired by them. My banking committee was Willis Robertson, the father of Pat Robertson. You had Alan Ellender in agriculture from Louisiana. You had John McClellan on government operations from Arkansas. Bill Fulbright from Arkansas, foreign relations. You had Spessard Holland from Florida, who basically controlled all the agricultural appropriations. All across the South, you had Russell Long, chairman of finance. There was no power committee that wasn't run, usually with two or three people right behind them, by Southerners. That was the old system. And that's what we were abandoning. The Republicans, realizing that millions of Southern voters were fleeing the Democratic Party, set out to woo the disaffected. Many black leaders, reeling from disappointment and violence, questioned whether nonviolence could really work. Things were really exploding in ways it rarely occurs in American politics. I firmly believe that the Democrats made the right decision by prohibiting segregation in future conventions. And I worked hard to make sure that we kept our promise to Mississippi. I went to Mississippi often afterwards to help the heirs of the Freedom Democrats build an integrated party. And then in 1968, now as Humphrey's co-chair, I went back to Mississippi again, right before the 68 convention, to pledge our support for the seating of the integrated delegation. I remember that because when I got back to Washington, John Stennis called me into the office and gave me a royal chewing out. He said, "This is a terrible blow, and it's not well received." Thanks to the new rule, whites-only delegations were no longer welcome at our convention. In 1968, an integrated delegation came from Mississippi, which included Aaron Henry, Ed King, Lawrence Guyot, and Fannie Lou Hamer. Mississippi had only six black elected officials in 1964, but by 1987, Mississippi ranked first in the nation with 803 black elected officials. And glory be, when President Carter and I were elected in 1976, it was Mississippi that put us over the top. Mike Espy was the first black congressman from Mississippi since Reconstruction. In the election of Bill Winter, an outspoken civil rights advocate, to the governorship in 1979, was further proof that things were changing. But the Democratic Party paid a price in the short run for choosing integration. Millions of white voters boldened to Wallace and to Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. This shift resulted in what has been described as the Southernization of the Republican Party. Over time, all of those Southern Democrats were out of there and replaced by Republicans. It was still a solid South, but it was Republican and not Democrat. And with time, it gave us Trent Lott, Jesse Helms, Newt Gingrich, and Tom DeLay. The change was so extreme that I remember John Sherman Cooper, a Republican senator from Kentucky, and a saint, telling me that he was quitting the Senate because he'd given up hope that the Republican Party would remain faithful to Abraham Lincoln. He didn't like what they were doing on race, and he said he was too old to do anything about it. These changes are still a reality in Southern politics. In 1980, Ronald Reagan started his national campaign for the presidency in Philadelphia, Mississippi, pleading for states' rights. And even in the current campaign, we hear candidates refusing to support the removal of the Confederate flag from South Carolina's state capitol. The civil rights community experienced its own upheaval after Atlantic City. Some embittered civil rights leaders adopted a more radical stance, believing that change wouldn't happen through peaceful means, that blacks should establish their own power rather than to seek integration. And I think it was 1967, the SNCC organization expelled their white members. But many more civil rights advocates, despite all the disappointments and provocation, kept the faith with Martin Luther King's message of nonviolence, integration, moderation, and decency. They are the heroes in this story, for they literally held our nation together when things were falling apart. It was their courage, patience, and faith that turned the civil rights dream into a reality. Many of them later, like Andy Young, Eleanor Holmes Norton, and John Lewis, became prominent national leaders. Some were less prominent, like the other Freedom Democrats, or the three white members I mentioned earlier, who sat down at the convention even though their lives were threatened. Now, after all these years, we can see something else. What they saw came true. Martin Luther King once told an audience of white businessmen that segregation was inefficient as well as unjust, that it held back progress in all of the South, and that it was unpatriotic to smirch the name of America with this offense. He was right. Thanks to the Civil Rights Act, the remarkable Warren Court, and the opening of the Democratic Party, America is now a profoundly better nation. Despite the many deep problems that remain, and they are many, the elimination of official discrimination has permitted us to tap much more of our talent. King was also right in saying that racism is unpatriotic, for it profoundly weakened America's international stature. Paradoxically, it is the South which resisted these changes that has benefited most of all. During the days of Jim Crow, the South was a backwater. When I first traveled down there, I think that's a fair description. Certainly, King's prediction has come true in the miraculous Southern bounty of recent decades. Sunbelt prosperity, a cultural boom, major league sports, and Olympic Games, all because we adopted civil rights. In a most fundamental sense, the South owes its prominence and prosperity largely to the courage of the Freedom Democrats and to the historic shift of the civil rights laws backed by the Democratic Party. It should remind us that decency is not just nice, it is necessary, and it works. Although creating a more perfect union was one of our nation's most perfect goals, from the very beginning, slavery and racial discrimination drove an ugly gash through the middle of America, dividing North from South from the very day of our founding. Take Minnesota and Mississippi. You would think that these two states, both in mid-America, bound together by our great river, would have had closely bound histories. But that wasn't so. Because of race, we have lived apart, been at war, and might as well have been living on different planets during most of our history. Our civil rights progress now allows our state and nation to come together in that more perfect union that we pledged to build in the first place. It's tempting to look back from today's vantage point and think these victories were inevitable, but none of it was preordained. All of it was very hard to come by. So when you hear people say that citizens can't do anything, that it is foolish to become involved, that nobody listens, please tell them to take a hard look at American history, and while you're at it, take a look at Fannie Lou Hamer as well. When I spoke in Biloxi, Mississippi, to the young Democrats in 1966, when they were, that was the Freedom Democrats at work, I told them, quote, someday the whole country will listen to Mississippi. You will have emancipated us all. And God bless them, so they have. Thank you.